Welcome to another episode of In Conversations, an Investec focused radio podcast series that offers insights into a wide range of topics that will empower our clients to create, manage, preserve, and grow their wealth. As South Africa approaches elections, we embarked on a three-city roadshow to find out just what public-private partnerships are developing to deal with issues that are top of mind for South Africans as they head to the polls. In our last episode, we dealt with the social contract developing in Joburg, and journalist Ferial Hefeji had some insightful conversations with the panel about the developments at Eskom, AI-driven security initiatives, and the renewable energy transformation that is underway. In this episode, we focus on Cape Town, where Ferial spoke to Investec CEO Kumesh Mudlia, Fumani Mthembi, co-founder and director of Billy Energy Group, Rayburn Hendricks, CEO at H1 Holdings, Renel Stander, CEO at Westgrow, and finally, Ravi Naidu, Yes for Youth CEO.
There are big political questions about the direction Narendra Modi has taken India, but its economy is something else. It really is cranking up amazingly. And it's the work of extremely good partnerships between business and the government that's driving it. What I've been really excited to find is that there's a similar social contract underway in South Africa. And we're seeing the benefits of it coming through, which I hope we'll get to this evening. For Fumani Mthembi, it's wonderful to be here with you. May I ask firstly, do you think 20 days of no load shedding is political wrangling, or is it actually the reforms coming through? Because when I read about Pele, after I met you, I went to read a lot. I mean, you guys are cracking it.
Ferial Hefeji. It's lovely to be here. Thank you. I mean, I think that's a very loaded question because we've seen this kind of behavior on the part of our state before. I say the Billy position is that we do have a lot of faith, particularly in the Minister of Electricity. I'm not certain. I really am not certain what's going on right now. Am I hopeful that this does mean that we've turned the corner? Absolutely. But I think at this stage, it's too early to say, you know, so I wouldn't get behind either of the positions. I don't like being pessimistic. That's why I'm an entrepreneur. And we're betting on the future, but I really can't say.
Okay, that's a fair comment. But do tell us about what's working for you. Was the dropping of the licensing cap on independent energy, has that been good for Pele?
Absolutely. I mean, the story of Pele is, you know, whilst we find ourselves in the renewable energy sector, this is not where we necessarily sought to be. We wanted to be change makers doing something that would move society forward in South Africa. So Billy primarily was a development company, and this is why the five founders are not engineers. We have no background in anything to do with electricity. You know, we're all actually majority in the banking sector. We founded the business to do something about development, but appreciating that there is power in private capital, and private capital actually has the ability to create a lot of public good. So that is how we sort of initiated Billy. And soon afterwards, the state then announced the Renewable Energy Independent Power Producers Program. And that for us became the marriage of concept and opportunity, you know. And I think in talking about where South Africa can go, the conversation really is about appreciating that there are so many opportunities that are in fact created by our own state. And the opportunities, as a function of, I think, our country's history and the many capacity gaps that exist in society, then require us to meet them not purely, you know, sort of through a narrow profit kind of lens, but to take a developmental perspective on what can be done. So our energy assets we see as anchors for development in regions of the country that are mostly unknown to people, you know, who are centered in the big in the big metros. We don't have to be the government in order to ensure that more people receive a decent education. We don't have to be the government to ensure that more people have access to decent jobs, skills that are necessary for the future of the economy. We do all of this using our private assets and in having these private assets and amazing partnerships, including a partnership with Investec, what we're able to do is leverage what is effectively a CSI budget to access even more capital for the development of those communities. So that's the story of Billion. And, you know, whilst the recent changes in legislation have made things even better, I think the emphasis for me is on the fact that in 2011 already, the government had created a platform that enabled our participation as five young Black people who had zero financial capital to participate in the sector and to approach it in a you know, fairly novel way, because that is the kind of opportunity that exists in our country.
That's a counterfactual, fabulous story. Can you share with us one place where you've seen your development dream beginning to happen, or is it too early days?
My absolute favorite community for us is the community of Thirst Refeer, which happens to be here, actually, in the Western Cape, but it's a bit of a drive away from where we are now. So our theory of change is that capable people provided with modern infrastructure are able to participate meaningfully in society. And how we affect that is by focusing on people, modernizing infrastructure, and ultimately industrializing the community. And in Thirst Refeer, we've been able to have a very sort of deep focus on skills development and transition the people that we've been working with from a skills development perspective into some of our infrastructure programs. So something we're really proud of is that all the schools in Thirst Refeer are solar powered, and that's been driven by us. And then in addition, you know, we've set up a community center where young people can access the internet and so forth, but they also come there for various training programs, including renewable energy skills training. And, you know, where you see sort of the strategy really come together is in our having established a hydroponic farm, a commercial scale hydroponic farm in that community. And what we've done there is tapped into the nature of the existing workforce, which, you know, historically has been geared towards the agri sector within the Western Cape, and said to ourselves, as we did in renewables, you know, there's a way to get into a sector without needing 100 years of family history. And renewables allow you to get into energy without needing ESCOM kind of history. And hydroponic farming for us has allowed us to be in that sector without needing, you know, knowledge of traditional farming. And in that way, we've created jobs and established a new industry and are hoping to create value chain linkages that will continue to modernize the community. So we're really proud of this.
I would love to come and see that. So Rayburn, is there an energy revolution happening, or is that too big a thing?
I think globally there is an energy revolution happening. There are revolutions happening from a technological perspective, from this fossil fuel to more like distributed networks. For example, in South Africa, our grid was like set up to burn coal in Mpumalanga and send it elsewhere to like the country. And really what we're seeing right now is we've got lots of other generation happening in all parts of like the country at different times of the day. Solar in the day, wind in the morning and in the night, not in Mpumalanga, in the main. And that's, in our space, that's a massive revolution that's going on in terms of how the grid needs to work, how the grid needs to be managed, how it needs to be funded. Like the big problem at the moment is we don't have enough grid in the areas where the best renewable resources are. And that's going to be the investment
theme
of our
time. That's the next story.
Yeah.
So, Kumesh Mudlia, as you start your new job now, you're also a longtime member of the CEO Initiative. Don't you want to take us inside that partnership and tell us how it works, how it came to be?
Firstly, just in terms of my own involvement, a bit of a proviso. I stepped into the role of CEO in the last 2 weeks for Investec. So I joined the CEO Initiative going forward. We were represented as Investec, though, by my predecessor, Richard Wainwright. And I've been a party to, and obviously getting myself up to speed with the work of the CEO Initiative. And I think our involvement from an Investec perspective has been along with 130 other CEOs of institutions in South Africa. And it was based on an absolute realization that we can't sit back as business and see critical areas of infrastructure and the economy fall apart. So the initiative created three key work streams around energy, which was obviously the big ESCOM debate and a lot of work that was set up there, and a committee called NECOM that was set up to support that. Infrastructure and logistics, crime and corruption, those were the three key work streams that were set up through the CEO initiative.
Are these great partnerships election-proof?
Cheryl, I think that there isn't an easy answer to that. So one is to look at what is the framework and how do you look at that. So I think a couple of good signals to look at is, and it starts with some of the smaller things that sometimes go unnoticed. If I look at the fact that the president's renewed the term of the current governor of the Reserve Bank for a further 5 years, it talks to monetary policy consistency on the one level. We look also similarly from a SARS perspective, the extension of the term of the commissioner of SARS or Inland Revenue. All of those things talk to some form of stability and in the fiscal or rather in the monetary policy arena. The next steps, and I think in many of these things, one of the major concerns is that as you look at it, again, looked at headlines in the last couple of days, our longest running Minister of Finance, Trevor Manuel Nani's capacity as chairperson of one of the biggest life insurers, says about R1 trillion has left the country. The ability for South Africa to continue to attract international capital is at risk over time. And I think the ability for government to continue to raise its bonds, etc., also gets to a point where there's saturation in the market or less appetite. Private capital has to step in. So I think in a post-election environment, what you're going to see is greater involvement of private capital, potentially, together with government and state sector. I think the point that Fumani made that is critical is that you can't regenerate a different inequality pattern in a particular sector. Energy, water, sanitation, etc. All of those in security. So the role of the state still has to be acknowledged. And it's how do we partner that?
Yeah. So, Ronel, I do want to start with, last week, pictures were going around social media. Queen Mary's II and Queen Victoria were in the harbour. I believe that you went to visit them. What was that like?
It was quite amazing. That is the first time that we had the two queens in a harbour in Africa ever. It was fabulous. We had 11,000 passengers, two-way passengers. So some passengers were disembarking and others were embarking. The vessels were also on a turnaround visit, so that meant that far from the ship being refueled, we also had to put fresh produce onto it, vessel maintained, etc. So that's really, really great for the economy.
It's fabulous. Yeah. You said that some of your people are abroad at a major cruising congress. Is South Africa becoming a bit of a safe haven in a time of war? I mean, do we have the Houthis to thank for this diversion of lots of maritime traffic?
To some extent, yes. So we were expecting, we're certainly going to be seeing a lot more ship calls at the Port of Cape Town because of the Red Sea situation. And so vessels are actually coming here. And what we have heard, we've got a team at the moment in Miami at Sea Trade. And what they have indicated is that, the itineraries for next year are being planned now. And they're probably going to continue to pass through the Western Cape. Yeah,
it's really excellent. We'll hear some more stories about what's driving the Western Cape's growth. Ravi, as CEO of the Youth Employment Service, I've been reading a lot, and it really is the issue, youth unemployment. It's driving this election. I was reading Larry Fink's letter, his annual letter, where he was decrying the loss of hope in the U.S. He said that for him was the biggest trend. And wherever I speak, I see the same thing here too. Could you tell us some stories which show us how to get through perhaps our most fundamental challenge is how do we bring young people into this economy so they're not at the glass looking in?
I think the best way to future-proof a country is to prepare its youth, capacitate, empower them for the future. So even if we didn't have that figure of 59% youth unemployment, we would still have to look at how we prepare youth for the future. Future, because sectors are changing, job categories are changing. All countries, whether they have 0% youth unemployment or 59%, are having to look at how you prepare for the future. So it's like the best endowment you could make for the future. So anything keeping up at night, what's the future going to be like? Are we sustainable? The answer comes down to how are we preparing people for it. So the Youth Employment Service is a public-private partnership. It was set up in 2016, 2017 as a discussion, essentially, with all the CEOs, just like the three committees now have been set up in terms of infrastructure. It was set up when the private sector identified what are the key things facing sustainability in the long term. And then there was a deal between the government and the private sector to say, if the private sector makes a contribution to youth employment, what will the government give in exchange? And that was the negotiation. So when it started, there was a person you might have heard of called Stephen Kosseff, who was quite involved. He was in the CEO of Investec. And Investec was the first sponsor for the Youth Employment Service and, in fact, incubated it. And the idea was, if there was leadership and good implementation, others will join. How to scale? So when it started, there's one investor, and yes, started in the offices of Investec. And today there's 1,700 companies that fund the program.
Why is that such a hidden story?
Well, I mean, it's now you know. So we focus more on the jobs, right? But it's kind of unique in that it's the only program which is 100% funded by the private sector. And I'm trying to get it less hidden because it often gets conflated with all the public sector programs, which are heavily funded by governments. And what we're doing is the program really takes, it tries to unlock value. So in terms of unlocking value, but the value is in people. So it tries to take high potential youth from very poor households who will never get a crack into the real economy. And it says, okay, if you want to be sustainable, we need to get the best talent into the game because that's how you broaden the base. That's how you fuel key sectors going forward. So that's the story. It starts with one. It's something is working. I think there are very few good social social citizen corporates that are not in YES now. There are a few that aren't, and if there are any in the room, we'll track them down.
Your telcos are in, your banks are in, your...
A lot of the banks. So a big chunk of the JSE that is concerned about sustainability is actually in. But I'll give you an example of maybe, the approach we're trying to take in terms of empowering people. So we run a fairly large program for drone pilots. So the youth join and can actually become a commercial drone pilot. So we have a typical example here in the Western Cape. It started here. It was a program funded initially by Google, NASPERS, and Transnet. And a young woman, she lives with her grandparents and her parents. Grandparents are employed. The mother works a little bit as a domestic worker, siblings, but there's no real jobs. She got a D or C, I think, in maths, which is kind of the requirement to be for the pilot's license. She joins the program. She just lucky she gets in. She passes in 3 months her CAA pilot's license to be a drone pilot, the heavy drones.
Fabulous.
No one will give you a job with just a license because you'll crash the drone. You have to show you could fly a heavy commercial drone. So the rest of the 12-month program, you're now working. At the end, she's a qualified pilot. She is now working in the security company doing all the surveillance stuff. It'll probably be part of the drone strategy they'll announce in the Western Cape. We have done 500 pilots. The total program this year in different sectors is 37,000 people. We've done
500 pilots.
500 pilots.
Great.
All funded by the private sector. So in her case, she and some of her mates decided, no, they want to be a pilot, but they want to actually have their own company and subcontract to another drone company so they can do contracts in agriculture, mining, whatever. So if we did 37,000 people this year, of whom 15% set up their own enterprise, you think how many of them, and this is for 1 year, are in the future going to be impactful in the in the country? We don't know all their stories. But I can tell you, just looking at the people coming through, you're like, okay, I can see you in 5 years doing this. I can see you in 10 years doing this. So the more of them we get into the game, the better. So far we've done 140,000. This year ended March with 37,000. It is a public-private partnership started and funded by the private sector.
Thank you very much for that. It's a real mood changer, don't you agree? Mm-hmm. Kamesh, the risk that business takes over, the work that should be government's, and what are the sunset clauses if there are, or is that just the nature of our country, this is how it's going to be?
some of the discussion that we had was absolutely that the role of business is not to replace government. The role of business is to support government and to work with civil society in that support of government. So I think it's a tripartite engagement in my view, because I also think civil society has to hold government accountable. Government actually has to be held accountable for the service delivery that taxpayers and that residents who should be the beneficiaries of those services are simply not receiving in many areas. So that's the one point. I think the second point for me is at a philosophical level, absolutely we must talk about sunset clauses. We must talk about capacitating the state to deliver. So I think that's part of it. The role of business. You often take that first position where you can. There's an element of risk. You do that, and with the hope that that becomes catalytic, that the progress comes out of the momentum of the projects itself by the people who are really competent in running these projects. And the second part is that you inspire others to take that next step. That's the role that we have to play. The risk is that we all sit back. And I can just give one simple example in Johannesburg. Our offices in Grayston Drive in Sandton, for those of you who know where our offices are, is at one of the busiest intersections in Sandton. The traffic lights outside would always go down when there was load shedding. You had gridlocked intersections, one of the busiest intersections in Sandton. We engaged the Johannesburg Roads Agency about how could we actually wanted to look at a solar-powered, renewable-type solution. We were told that there wasn't an easy way to secure it. We went through a bit of a process, and we landed up actually just connecting it into our backup generator at our office. But with getting appropriate approvals, it took us 3 or 4 months to do it, at no cost to the Johannesburg municipality. Subsequent to that, 37 other corporates in that broader area have done similar initiatives. But it took a lot of effort from some of our team to pave the way, go and get the documentation approved, see what was needed, and create a bit of a precedent for that. Now, I think there are many people, I'm sure, in this audience, and there are many stories, I think Ronel's spoken about, for Moni, Rayburn, and Ravi, where those initiatives are taken by individuals. If we do it on the precondition to say you need to do it, that you need to have a sunset clause or that you're replacing the role of the state, very little of that would happen. And the risk is when you've got that one country, this is the one country we all live in, we need to make it happen. Mm-hmm. And yes, there are going to be trade-offs.
Yeah. Thank you for the traffic lights. It makes things much easier. So, Ronel, I was loving going through your deck, huh? These stories are fabulous. So there's been a 25% growth in the flights coming to Cape Town. Is that right? Mm. Eh? 25 airlines now, a direct link into China. You told us about the cruises. 79 missions went abroad. Tell us the story of behind the statistics. How is Cape Town driving such a great growth strategy?
Yeah. So I think first of all, there's a visionary leadership team, and there is good governance. I think that is fundamentally what underpins everything that happens here. There is a competent bureaucracy, and the bureaucracy is not only competent, they're also innovative. So I'm not sure if you are aware of the Rapid Schools Build program, but we've built the government has built 25 new schools. They have added 1,000 classrooms. And they've used an innovative building technology. In addition to that, there is a lot of public-private partnerships happening in the Western Cape. I want to give you an example of just three that we run as Westgrow. The first is the Cape Town Air Access, which is a public-private partnership where what we're really wanting to do is to attract as many international air services to the Western Cape. We've seen a direct correlation between increased air access and economic growth. And obviously also, so for every 100 air travelers that arrive, international air travelers that arrive, we create one job. And just to give you an example, last year we added 13 direct services between the Western Cape and the USA, connecting three cities, Atlanta, New York, and Washington. You try and get a seat on any of those flights,
it's impossible.
Mm-hmm. Impossible. And if you do get a seat on a business class seat, it'll be 200,000 rand. There's a huge demand. We're also at the moment talking to another American carrier to connect us with Miami, which will also be really, really phenomenal. So that's Cape Town Air Access. We also run Cruise Cape Town, where we try and attract vessels, cruise vessels to the Western Cape. And then I think another really interesting thing is that there's a lot of emphasis and a lot of focus on building investor confidence in the Western Cape. What we saw during COVID was that a lot of the Western Cape businesses grew and expanded rather than having foreign direct investment. So we spend a lot of time trying to build investor confidence in the Western Cape. And that takes a whole range of, interventions. One of it is that every second month we host CEOs at the Premier's residence together with the mayor. And we basically talk about what is possible and what we need to do in the Western Cape. But really, really, I think probably one of the biggest things that I think the Western Cape is getting right, and that is the shift from consumptive spending to spending in infrastructure. So the city of Cape Town, just as an example, has a 120 billion rand program over 10 years, where they're looking at investment into sewage, into sanitation, into water reuse system, into rapid bus transit systems, and then also there's a big initiative to ensure a kind of mitigation against load shedding. So I don't know if you're aware, but the Western Cape at the moment is one level lower when it comes
to load shedding. I see it on Eskom's The Push painfully.
Yeah, that's obviously because of the Steenbras Hydro project, but there's a second phase to that. So there's a lot of work happening, and I think there's what I can certainly say, having worked both at a national level and in the Western Cape, I can certainly say that if I have a big investor here and I need to have that investor meet with the Premier or the Mayor, I can call them and I can be assured that they will be given an audience. It's not something that I experience anywhere else. So I think those are, in a nutshell, some of the reasons why the Western Cape seems to be doing well.
Thank you. Thank you very much for those insights. Really interesting. Ranelle, final question. Quietly, do the heads of the Eastern Cape and Gauteng and other provinces call you up and say, how do we do this? And are you willing to share?
Yeah, we are, and we do. So we often have delegations come and visit us, and we share what it is that we do. But increasingly, we are also looking to do joint projects with other provinces. So just recently, we were in Eastern Cape, and we met with the Director General of the Eastern Cape, the Northern Cape, and the Western Cape. And we discussed an opportunity, the green hydrogen opportunity. You just reminded me of that. And we were looking at actually forming a Western production corridor of green hydrogen. Yes. And then we're wanting to obviously also connect with Namibia. And there's a whole lot of work happening where the Dutch, for example, are doing a pre-feasibility study on connecting, you know, from Lüderitz to Saldanha Bay, a green hydrogen pipeline. We're on that committee. So apart from, you know, looking at the kind of traditional sectors and the traditional markets, we're also very actively looking at new sectors and new markets, with a lot of work also happening in trying to expand our products into Asia, ASEAN, and the Middle East. So there's a lot of work also going on just in terms of opening some of those markets.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for tuning in to InvestTech in Conversation, our thought leadership series that offers insights into relevant topics impacting our times. Don't forget to subscribe to InvestTech Focus Radio SA so that you don't miss out on any of our insights.
The views expressed are those of the contributors at the time of publication and do not necessarily represent the views of the firm and should not be taken as advice or recommendations. Investec Private Banking, a division of Investec Bank Limited, a registered credit provider committed to the Code of Banking Practice as regulated by the Ombudsman for Banking Services.